how many of you have had the experience of when the phone rings, you seem to know sometimes exactly who's calling. Also, I wonder how many of you have had the experience of knowing when you're being stared at.
Why do you feel like that?
And also, I wonder how many of you have had the experience of somehow intuiting when someone dear to you, someone near to you, is in some kind of distressing situation. So many people can claim to such experiences, but current science as we know it has no explanation for this. In fact, 90% of science as we know it today doesn't address such phenomena. Let's look at the subject of mystic powers from a very interesting angle. Actually, every creature, every species of life has some mystic power. If you consider that mystic power is art in terms of dealing with material nature. Birds can fly. If you consider that as a yogic power, that's endowed in the body. Fish can breathe underwater. Human beings can't do any of this. Of course, human beings have developed consciousness to have a discussion like we're having now. And that indeed is mystic power when viewed from the standpoint of other species. If you heard about a human being that could fly or who could breathe underwater without scuba diving equipment, you'd be very interested. So first let's establish that mystic power is species bound. Different species of life have different yogic abilities. Earthworms, they eat earth and pass it out to the other end in a way that's more fertile for agriculture. This is mystic potency. Okay, let's focus now just on human beings. You may be very interested to know that what is considered mystic power in one part of the world, what's considered a miracle in one culture, is considered passé in another culture. For example, if we took a typical villager from India and explained about technological innovations like flying in airplanes, and going underground in subways, going in submarines underwater, such a villager in a remote part of India would be astonished. And invariably, what would they say in their own terminology? It's a miracle. Now let's go to the other part of the world and look at where we live without judging the spiritual sanctity of anyone. If a Westerner hears that someone can fly through the air or walk on water, the typical Western person's astonished. And what will he or she say? It's a miracle. Go to a remote village in India and present regardless of the spiritual sanctity of persons who are able to walk on water, just tell a villager in a remote part of India, "We want to tell you about someone who can walk on water." "Oh, there's 5 of those in the next village." "We want to tell you about someone who was buried and then 3 days later appeared outside of their tomb." Again, people will say, "Well, not exactly 5 in the next village, but somewhere in this area, there's a yogi we've heard who can do that." So my point is, let's consider the cultural lenses through which we're looking at mystic powers. Sometimes, indeed, spiritual teachers, in order to attract the attention of not very spiritually enlightened people, will use mystic powers and psychic abilities just to catch your eye. But that's not their real mission. The real mission is to connect living entities caught in illusion, connect them to the ultimate source of all spiritual power. So we've briefly discussed mystic powers in terms of the different species of life and how each species of life is practicing yoga. So the next time you see birds flying through the air, even birds singing, or watch a horse galloping with the mane flying in the air, this is yoga power. It's a different yoga power than what human beings ordinarily can do. And the next time you hear about the miracles of technology here in the West, understand that someone in another part of the world would consider it miraculous. And conversely, someone in another part of the world, when they hear about someone walking on water or even changing the weather, yes, yogis can do that. It's nothing abnormal. Let's now look at mystic powers in terms of our contemporary science that dominates the Western world. You'd be surprised to know that the latest surveys, polls in USA and Canada reveal that 60% of people think there's such a thing as mystic powers. And they're not just uneducated tabloid readers. Many conventional scientists protesting such surveys say, "This shows you that we need more science education." 60% of people actually believe in such foolishness as mystic powers. Obviously, such persons haven't finished high school. But no, the social research shows that the majority of that 60% are well-educated persons. An interesting study done in a scientific journal a few years ago revealed that scientists themselves will recognize that there are forbidden areas of research. There are areas of research which are, they may be very enticing and appetizing, but if you start delving into those areas, you look like a fool and you could lose your job, you could be ridiculed, you could lose your academic funding. Very important, academic funding. So better stay away from those areas of research if you value your prestige, if you value your career. There is a very small percentage of scientists who are actually doing research into what is called a psychic phenomena. The psychic phenomena that the Western world is preoccupied with, these things are actually listed in the ancient yoga texts as inferior mystic powers. There's primary mystic powers, secondary mystic powers, then there are inferior mystic powers. inferior mystic powers, or abilities like reading minds, becoming undisturbed by heat or cold. Doing things with your mind, influencing matter with your mind. These are considered inferior mystic powers. But our current science has trouble even with those inferior mystic powers to help the public understand these inferior mystic powers. Western terminology has developed. For example, the ability to see distant events or hear distant events and sights and sounds. That's called clairvoyance. Then there's something called precognition, the ability to see future events. There's something called telepathy, mind-to-mind communication. I was staying at Mata Hari's house this weekend with his yoga partner of 31 years? Yes. Because he was just joking with me. They had some communication gap momentarily. Just, well, we haven't achieved mental telepathy yet. So, perhaps you've heard of Uri Geller, famous in the 80s for his TV shows in which he would bend spoons with his mind. He even did a demonstration at the White House for a president, President Carter. His abilities were testified to by preeminent scientists. He's now, last I heard of him, he was working for multinational petroleum and gold corporations, using his psychic abilities to find new oil wells and new catches of minerals. When we look at major mystic powers, far beyond these trivial inferior mystic powers, we have to deal with the yoga texts, where they describe mystic abilities in which you can radically change the structure and characteristics of your material body. These powers have Sanskrit names. Anima City. Many of you have heard of yoga cities, yoga perfections. So Anima City means you can change the structure of your body so that you become as tiny as you want. Even at the beginning of the 20th century in India, it was quite common for yogis to allow you to put them in a box, and seal the box every kind of way, and then the yogi would appear outside the box. No one took this as any kind of hoax. They understood yogis have mystic powers. That ability to appear outside a box after having been locked up, that is a small demonstration, a tiny amount of this yogic power. Anima City becomes smaller than the smallest. Then there's the opposite, Mahima City, becoming greater than the greatest. You can make your body so huge it seems to fill the land and sky. That's not so commonly seen. Then there's Lagima City, in which you become so light you can float away on a breeze. Very cheap method of transportation. There are major yogic powers dealing with acquisition of objects in a way that is far beyond what human beings today can understand. You can reach anywhere on this planet. You can extend your grasp and get whatever you want. Not only on this planet, but also to other planets. You can also enjoy things that are far away on this planet and other planets. Your senses, in other words, extend beyond the conventional limits of the material body. Then there are major mystic powers in which you can actually do things that violate the laws of nature as we know it, in minor and major ways. There is one mystic power, major mystic power, that you see a slight trace of in this day and age. Maybe not so much now, but especially in the 70s, the 60s and 70s, it was happening. It still goes on now, but to a much lesser extent. There is a major mystic power in which you can control others' minds and get them to do what you want. So often, I observed in the 60s and 70s, yogis would come from India and just speak the strangest things, and people would become their adoring followers and hand over huge sums of money, hand over their wives, or... That is a perverted use of a major mystic power. It's a slight trace of a major mystic power in which you can enter someone's mind and control it. Most of the mystic powers that are commonly known to yoga practitioners are called secondary mystic powers. I'll read you a list of it. These are secondary. You can just imagine, well, this is secondary. Where's our civilization at these days? We can't have even more than a tiny glimpse of these secondary mystic powers. The power to escape hunger, thirst, and other physical disturbances. The skill of hearing sounds, no matter where they are vibrated. The skill of seeing events, regardless of their location. The ability to move in the body at the speed of mind. The capacity to assume whatever physical form one desires. If any of you are into UFO phenomena, this ability is commonly ascribed to aliens, that they can change their form, shape-shifting, it's called. That's a secondary mystic power. The power to enter the bodies of others and experience life within, in someone else's body. The ability to choose the moment of death. The expertise to issue commands that are always fulfilled. There are a few more. So that's enough to just give you a vision. These are secondary mystic powers. Now, if we look at our society today, we see what I like to explain, especially here in Toronto. There are some basic myths. Number one, money brings happiness. Myth number two, technology brings prosperity. Myth number three, weapons bring security. even in Canada. I know those Americans are, you know, bomb happy and gun happy. And number four, the earth gives you unlimited resources, as much as you want, without any problem. These myths are based around thinking of technology as mystic power. But that technology we have today is a very troublesome and inefficient mystic power, and it's having a great toll on society today. The lost yoga civilizations of ancient India also have technology. But it's a different kind of technology. It's not a technology based on factories or industries or engineers. It's a technology based on mystic power. That mystic power can be developed in various ways. We'll talk about that later. But first, let us try to lose our bias against the current form of technology we have now. Bias meaning we think it is the pinnacle of human advancement. But when you read the ancient yoga texts like Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam, you're introduced to another form of technology, which is far beyond what minds today can understand. How many of you have delved into or even read the whole book of Bhagavad Gita? Make the prime yoga text of India? Raise your hands, please. Very good. Do you realize what's happening in terms of the narration of Bhagavad Gita? It's coming to you by something scientists now will freely call remote viewing. The narrator of Bhagavad Gita was not present anywhere near the event that he was describing. Those of you who have read Bhagavad Gita, you remember in this classic yoga text, there's a blind king, Dhritarashtra, and he asks his secretary, what's happening on the battlefield? The blind king's sons were arrayed on the battlefield against an opposing force. So the blind king went, tell me what's going on. And his secretary told him the conversations on the battlefield, especially the conversation between Sri Krishna, known as Yogeshwara, the master of all mystic power, and his devotee Arjuna. So the secretary, Sanjaya, was able to word for word describe the conversation and describe what was happening on the battlefield, and he's nowhere near there. For so long, people in the Western world thought, this is certainly mythology. How can you relay a conversation and you're not even there and you don't have any modern technology? There's no television, there's no video cameras, no cell phones. I've explained before in other venues here in Toronto that from 1970 to 1994, both the former Soviet Union and the U.S. are on record for having spent millions of dollars using psychics for remote viewing to spy on each other's secret weapons facilities. In fact, during the presidency of Carter, I think that was in the 70s, Uri Geller, the famous spoon bender with his mind, he went to the White House and pleaded with the president, you've got to invest more money in psychic research, otherwise the Russians will grab the whole, they'll grab the lead, and that'll be a problem for the world. In any case, government documents now reveal the CIA spent $20 million with a cadre of psychic viewers who could just, from California, look anywhere in this former Soviet Union and describe the nuclear weapons factories, so on and so forth. Supposedly the project has been disbanded, but those who were involved in the project say it's going on even more extensively now. The government says, well, it just had a small, very small accuracy. But those involved, these psychics who were employed by the CIA, say it was 85% general accuracy and then a 5% stunning, astonishing accuracy. So you see, what for so long was considered mythology, now you find out the governments are spending millions of dollars developing and they don't talk about it now.
So much of what we think is far-fetched turns out to be cultural bias. With the advent in the Western world of yoga, people are starting to understand that if I discipline my body and mind, I can increase my abilities. Not simply that I'll be more supple and flexible, my organs will operate better, my circulation will be better, but I can have powers through discipline beyond what the ordinary person can have. And indeed, that is what mystic power is about. Through discipline, sense control, and mind control, you're developing abilities that will improve your material existence in this world. I have to give you a warning up front that, for example, in the graduate yoga text, Srimad Bhagavatam, there it is stated by the Yogeshwara, Krishna, the master of all mystic powers. He says, all these major, minor, and inferior mystic powers are actually bewildering, they're illusory. One should pursue the supreme mystic power, the supreme form of yoga, and connect with the ultimate source of all yoga power. That is the actual mystic perfection, the perfection of mystic yoga. Sometimes intelligent people from the West perceive, why should I develop mystic powers to walk on water when we have ferries, we have hydrofoils? Why should I develop mystic powers to fly when we have airplanes? What actually is the goal of mystic power? And when we start asking that kind of question, we start honing in on what is the ultimate goal of life. In looking at the lost yoga civilization of ancient India, we have a problem. So many other cultures have left behind things that you can see and touch. Bricks and stones and pyramids and temples and tombs and things you can get your hands on and believe in. But the record of the yoga powers in this lost part of history in ancient India is textual. It's sound vibration. We have to change our standard. Instead of seeing is believing, hearing is believing. Through sound vibration, you can actually experience. A crude example, if you're sitting in your house and you hear a siren of a police car go by, you can actually visualize the police car. You know that's a police car. You're actually in some way seeing by hearing. With spiritual sound, that reality is much more amplified and concentrated. With spiritual sound, there is no difference between the sound and the source of the sound. That's something to be experienced. We won't go into that at this point. So now, let's once again, remember, we have sonic traces of such an advanced mystic power civilization. We don't have stone monuments. We don't have Stonehenges. We don't have pyramids. We don't have sphinx. We have texts. And the texts are sound, recorded sound. If we utilize that recorded sound, if we enter the sonic laboratory, our experience of life can change. In this present day and age, it's practically impossible to develop the major mystic powers to their full extent. And you'll get slight traces of the secondary mystic powers and a bit more of the inferior mystic powers. with our short life, is that really the goal? The mystic powers actually are dealing with matter. They are refined materialism. Instead of manipulating matter in the gross ways known to human beings today, mystic powers mean manipulating matter in a much more refined way that's beyond most people's imagination today. Still, there's a problem. The manipulation of matter. Is that our goal in life? Is this how we want to try and enjoy in this world? So the ultimate mystic power deals with freedom from material existence. Freedom from material existence automatically means reconnection to the ultimate spiritual reality. That is what bhakti yoga is about. And the kirtan is the prime method of bhakti yoga for transforming our existence through sound. Let me describe some episodes from the ancient yoga texts. This one involves a temporary misuse of mystic power. There was a very adept yogi named Sovari Muni. This is described in the 9th canto of the spiritual encyclopedia, Srimad Bhagavatam. Sovari Muni was able to meditate underwater year after year, decade after decade, century after century. Even now, if you go to the Kumbh Mela gathering in India that's held every 12 years or so, no one is astonished to see yogis come from the Himalaya mountains who say that they're 500 years old. So Sovari Muni was able to meditate underwater without coming up for air, no scuba diving equipment, just that was his mystic power. While he was meditating underwater, he happened to see a pair of fish reproducing. And his mind became agitated. We know about mental agitation these days. You're walking through Toronto, on Bloor, and all the shops, and the smells, and the sights, and you get caught up, you get allured. People walking by, you look. Shop windows, you look. Sounds you hear. In fact, you notice how enlivened people get on a Friday evening. They like to go out and just bathe their senses in the sights and sounds and smells of nightlife. So this is agitation, which a yogi doesn't want. But in spite of Sovari Muni's expertise in meditation, he could just stay underwater. Now you might say, what's a yogi doing just living underwater? Where's the pleasure? The real pleasure the yogi understands is from within. The yoga texts say, Ramante yogino anante, satchananda chidatmani. The real pleasure is within. Meditating on the soul and the supreme soul. Both, not just one, but the two are always together. So Sovari Muni could do that. But he slipped a bit in his yoga practice. And therefore, when he saw the fish reproducing, his mind filled with thoughts. That's why this form of yoga is not recommended for this day and age. Imagine Sovari Muni walking on Bloor. This is a different time, a different civilization. So somehow or other he became vulnerable just by seeing two fish reproducing, and he decided, as old as I am, and as I'm looking like I spent a lifetime underwater. I should marry. So he came out of the water, and he went to the ruler of the area he lived in, and he presented himself. King, I would, you have daughters. I'd like that you hand over one of your daughters. So the king, being a shrewd diplomat, government leader, he looked at the yogi. You definitely look like you've been practicing yoga underwater for quite some time. The king thought to himself. But he didn't. The king realized that yogis have mystic power. You don't want to get on the wrong side of them. They can do things to you. So the king gave a tactful answer in return when the yogi requested, please, one of your daughters, hand me over a princess. The king said, well, to tell you the truth, whatever one of my daughters wants to marry you, she's free to do that. That's as good as saying no, of course. Because obviously the daughters would take one look at this very decrepit and feeble and old-looking yogi, and they would just say no. Sober Moody then went to Plan B. He went into seclusion, and with his mystic yoga power, he shape-shifted. Remember, that's a secondary mystic power, to turn your body into whatever form you like. He transformed himself by his yoga power, his accumulated yoga power through decades, centuries of austerities, discipline. He used that power to transform himself into a beautiful-looking prince. Now, you might say, well, that sounds pretty good. That sounds like a good use, a practical use of yoga. But actually, from the viewpoint of the yoga text, this is a misuse of yogic ability. It's a diversion. So the now transformed Sobri Muni, looking like the most dashing, gallant, strikingly handsome prince, returned to the palace. The king took one look and said, come right in. Here's the doorway to the part of the palace where my daughters live. And Sobri Muni walked in, and the king's daughters, whereas before they were repulsed, now they began fighting. He's meant for me. No, no, no. He's just right for me. He's not compatible with you. So Sobri Muni decided, well, since they're all fighting over me, and there were quite a few of these daughters of the king, he said, I might as well just marry all of them. How did he maintain all these princesses? With his yogic power. He created beautiful residences for each of them. He created luxuries, interior decorations, interior furniture, all of his mystic power. Because remember, as some scientists are discovering today, mind can influence matter. Well, Sobri Muni was beyond mind influencing matter. He was at the point of mind creating matter, manifesting matter. Not that he created the energy of matter, but he could make the already existing energy of matter appear in various objects. This is far beyond Uri Geller's bending a spoon with his mind. Sobri Muni could actually manifest a spoon. Silver spoon, a gold spoon, and house and furnishings. So naturally, his wives were very happy. Sobri Muni enjoyed with them for quite some time. But after a while, he began to remember his yoga training and his yoga experiences, and he began to wonder, I have been enjoying night and day with these beautiful princesses for decades, and I'm still not satisfied. What's going on? I've just allowed myself to become the servant of my senses, and I'm not happy. His example teaches us a great lesson, that until we become master of our mind and senses, we'll never be satisfied. This is exactly the opposite of the message current society is teaching you. What's the message you get now? The more you let your mind and senses run loose, the more chance you have to be fulfilled and satisfied. Therefore, you see so many persons with their own mantra. It's like Buddha Hari was giving us the divine spiritual sound of the Hare Krishna mantra. Well, people also have mantras that are more commonly practiced. Work, buy, consume, die. That's actually a mantra. Now, I hope none of you are cultivating that mantra. Work, buy, consume, die. Work, buy, consume, die. No, we don't want that. Sober Moody had a very astute, very lucid realization. What is the use of all this luxurious, sensual indulgence, all powered by my mystic abilities? I'm dissipating all my mystic power, which has been built up over centuries of precise discipline, precise practice, and now it's all gone to materialistic purposes. And I'm not even satisfied. I'm not even happy. He got this realization in the last part of his life. So he decided, it's the appropriate time for me to retire from this charade, retire from this unnecessary diversion. And he went back to the pond, entered within, and this time with greater determination resumed his meditation on the Supreme Absolute Truth. And he gives us that lesson by his example, misuse of yoga power. Another example of mystic power, especially relevant in these days when people are dissatisfied with their governments. Often it's said that the Western world is having an institutional crisis in which people no longer expect their governmental institutions to actually solve problems. It's just not expected anymore. You pay your taxes, and what you get in return, well, you take what you get and leave it at that. So it's interesting, the yoga texts describe that there was a very extraordinarily magnanimous and competent ruler. But he had a very bad son. The son was so bad that the king lost all hope in reforming his son and retired from his monarchy prematurely and just left to go to the forest to meditate and develop his yoga power in solitude. So the sages who advise governments, that's the model we get from the ancient yoga texts, that powerful government leaders always have an advisory board of sages, sadhus, yogis, who give them spiritual insights in terms of how to benefit the people spiritually. So the sages realize there's no strong government leader, and when there's no strong government leader, that means undesirables, criminal elements will start to overrun society because it's not a strong curbing force. And indeed, that's what happened right before the sages' eyes. So they began to deliberate amongst themselves. They had a convocation, a meeting of sages and sadhus and mystic yogis for the benefit of the people. See, that's the real purpose of yoga, is to benefit others after benefiting yourself. Make your life perfect and then help others to do the same. So yoga, mystic powers, actually are not selfish. Just like my spiritual teacher, who brought bhakti yoga out from India and spread it all over the world. news reporters have often asked him, well, can you show us some mystic power? He said, yes, I can show you mystic power. Just see, I have taken people in the West who are addicted to meat eating and gambling and random lust affairs and intoxication, and I've turned them into yogis who control their mind and senses and are fixed on the ultimate source. They're fixed on Krishna. The news reporters replied, it's just definitely mystic power. I remember during the early days of Bhakti Yoga in the West, it's my spiritual teacher, Srila Prabhupada, he started in the village, Greenwich Village in New York, in 1966-67. So at that time, his first students, so many of them were draft dodgers who hadn't run away to Canada. They just decided, we'll just keep a low profile. We won't register for the army. We don't want to go to Vietnam, to the jungles in a meaningless war. And we'll just hang out in the village, and the FBI won't be able to find us, because it's a federal crime in the USA not to register with the army so you can go to Vietnam. So many of my associates in bhakti, in Krishna consciousness from that time, they just went across the border to Canada. Canada was the refuge during the Vietnam War. So anyway, these students, they didn't. And they were Srila Prabhupada's first students. So eventually the FBI caught up with them. And that's what Americans pay their taxes for. So they had to go to court. And the usual penalty, once you were caught draft dodging, dodging military conscription, not registering for it, the usual penalty was you choose. Either you go to prison or you go to the front lines in Vietnam. So the judge was hearing their presentation, because they were saying, we are religious objectors, we are living a spiritual life, we are following a disciplined life, which will not be, it won't correspond to life in the army. And of course the judge had heard all these kind of presentations before from so many phonies, so he was not interested. Sorry, heard it all before. You hippies, I know where you're at, you countercultural. You're not doing your duty to the nation. You're shirking your honor. So finally, it looked like these practitioners of bhakti, these first practitioners of bhakti in the Western world, they're either going to go to prison or go to the front lines of Vietnam. So they began to describe, as their last resort, they began to describe to the judge the lifestyle that they followed. We rise at 4 a.m. in the morning. The judge, really, 4 a.m. And as fully committed bhakti practitioners, we don't take any form of intoxication. The judgment, he thought, oh, drugs. Good, you don't take drugs. Not even alcohol or coffee. The judge kind of, not alcohol or coffee. We don't gamble. The judge, not gambling. And we don't have random lust affairs. The judge grimaced. And then he thought about it, and then he gave his verdict. I think you guys are the real thing. I believe you now that you are genuine spiritual practitioners. I myself, rather than follow those rules and that behavior, I'd rather go to Vietnam and die. Send me to the jungles in Vietnam, I'll die in the war rather than follow those kind of behavioral guidelines. So, this is our situation today. But these yogis who were advising the government head, they realized we don't have any government head who can benefit the people. And therefore, the people will be subject to exploitation by unsavory elements in society. We've got to pick someone. There doesn't seem to be anyone around qualified. Perhaps we just have to turn to this son of the king who left. Even though this son is, he's got bad character, at least he's strong. At least he's determined, and he'll cut down on the unsavory elements, although he'll probably cause a lot of problems himself. They felt they had no other recourse. So indeed, they put the son in charge. And certainly, the bad elements were cut down. They were curbed. At the same time, this king began to assert himself, I am the cause of all causes. I am the object of all meditation. All yoga should be performed for me, recognizing me as the ultimate goal. And the sages and yogis and sadhus were just horrified. Regardless of whatever law and order policing benefit he's having for society, he's doing an even greater harm by presenting his tiny, puny self as the ultimate and demanding that everyone acknowledge that. So how did these sages and yogis and sadhus deal with this affliction? Very serious affliction. They did a rare thing. With their yoga power, they terminated the king through sound. By making a high-pitched special sound, they finished off the king by their psychic powers through sound vibration. So that's another example of yoga power in action. It's a rare thing, because sadhus and yogis and sages, they don't like to interfere in political affairs, but for the benefit of the people, because things had gotten so bad, they did that. What kind of mystic power can we develop in our situation here in Toronto? We can become urban mystics. If we associate with the right sound vibration, our life can be transformed to one of interior development. Interior development means the connection between the soul and the supreme soul, in Sanskrit, between the Atma and Paramatma. The reciprocation between those two, that's what it's all about. That's the focus of the yoga system. So therefore, remember the beginning? I quoted from the yoga text Srimad Bhagavatam, where Krishna says, all those mystic powers listed, major, secondary, inferior, they're all illusory. They're actually just subtle materialism, refined and subtle ways of manipulating matter. But it's not your job to manipulate matter. Your job is to become free from the grip of matter. Therefore, I advise you to follow the supreme yoga, the supreme mystic power, which is freedom from material existence and connection to the supreme source of all energy, spiritual and material. Krishna gave that advice. In our situation, we live in a highly agitating and disturbing society. Stress is such a problem. Anxiety, as you know, is such a problem. Many people can't even live without having both the TV and radio on at the same time. Otherwise, they feel lonely. They feel terrified. I'm based in one of the most beautiful scenic places in the world, New Zealand. And the young people there, although living in such natural beauty, they have a high suicide rate between the ages of 12 and 25. The leading cause of death is suicide. Because they say it's so peaceful, it's so serene, we can hear ourselves think, and it's driving us crazy. We can't handle it. Therefore, they kill themselves. They can't live with themselves due to the serenity and quiet. So I'm sure you know people who have to bombard themselves in their apartments, in their homes, with TV, radio, all the time just to make them feel normal. Just the kind of times we're living in. Therefore, predicting that this kind of age with its circumstances would come, the yoga texts have advised, in this especially warped and distorted time, become free from material illusion through sound vibration, particularly the kirtan sound of mantra. And of all mantras, particularly what is called the Maha Mantra, the topmost mantra, because it relieves you from material illusion and simultaneously connects you to the supreme source of spiritual pleasure, connects you to Krishna. Just going back briefly, you can develop mystic powers by birth, just because your parents are competent yogis who, by their procreation, attract a top quality yogi to take birth in the family. That is possible. So you can develop mystic power just by birth, because you've developed them in a previous lifetime, and then parents who are yogis, due to their developed consciousness, they attract you to take birth in their family. This science of conception is explained by Krishna in Bhagavad Gita. According to the consciousness of the man and woman at the time of conception, a suitable quality child is attracted to the womb. This is unknown to Western science. So yes, you can develop mystic powers just by being born in the right family. You can develop mystic powers by herbs. You won't find that happening these days. Such herbs and the use of these herbs aren't known to mankind, human beings, womankind these days. You can develop mystic powers by cultivation, by practice. And you can develop mystic powers by your being empowered by someone else. Just like in Bhagavad Gita, I was talking to you about the secretary, Sanjaya, doing remote viewing, describing sights and sounds from a far-off place, minutely describing them. He, in Bhagavad Gita, says, I got this ability from my guru, my spiritual master, Vyas. So he's directly giving his autobiography. This is where I got the ability from, because I pleased my guru. I was infused with this mystic power, among other abilities. So what we can do to get the topmost mystic power, which is to escape material illusion and reconnect with the ultimate source, we can do that most effectively in this day and age through sound vibration. The most adept yogis in this day and age take shelter of spiritual sound. And the yoga texts advise, of all the spiritual sounds that you can utilize, the most direct and effective in this age is the Maha Mantra, the great mantra, the Hare Krishna mantra. Why? Is that sectarian to say that? No. No more sectarian than if you go to a pharmacy and the pharmacist says, for your condition, in your circumstances, this is the best medicine. And what would you say? Well, you got something against the other medicine now? What about all the other pills in the pharmacy? Why are you just recommending this one? No, you would take, you know what you're doing, you know my situation, you, or at least the doctor who prescribed the medicine should, unless he's been bribed by the pharmaceutical industry, which is normal. So the point is, though, ideally speaking, you trust the doctor or the pharmacist that they're recommending a particular prescription that will match your circumstances. You wouldn't accuse them of being sectarian. Similarly, the yoga texts recommend a particular mantra for a particular time and circumstances. Now, therefore, the yoga texts stress the Hare Krishna mantra in this time and circumstances especially. Because what is the use of developing refined materialism if we're still materialists? Sobrimuni realized that. I misused my mystic power to live a sensual life. I wasted all my centuries of yoga practice, all the powers I accumulated. I wasted them on just ordinary indulgences. What a fool I was. So we don't want to become the most refined materialists. We want to go beyond the realm of materialism. We want to enter the spiritual reality. And that's what the topmost mystic power does. So therefore, in conclusion, in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna himself says, of all the different types of yogis, the topmost yogi, the topmost mystic, is the one who is always connected to me in pure love and devotion. So bhakti yoga is the yoga of pure love and devotion, the most powerful mystic force.